If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How do you give readers the chills? How do you make the hairs stand up on the back of their necks? How do you grab them by the throat and subject them to an emotional experience that is unlike anything else they have read before? That is what we're going to be discussing in today's episode, all about Words of Radiance. Hello and welcome to the Novel Analyst Podcast. I'm Jed Hearn, and every episode it is my job to analyze a story to help you become a better writer. Today's episode is titled Words of Radiance by Brandon Sanderson, giving readers chills. So quick announcement before we start, I am improving the show's format, hopefully, a bit for what will hopefully make a better listening experience for you, and it will hopefully allow you to ask me some questions and just have some more engagement, and it should contribute to a better show. So the new format of the show will involve a personal update just to start each episode off really quickly, letting you know what I've been working on, if there's like cool writing or reading things I've done recently, something quick like that. Then we'll have our deep dive into analyzing that show's book, the, you know, normal analyst set, bit of the package. And then we will have a question segment at the end. And if you would like to submit a question for me to potentially answer on the show, you can go to jedhearn.com/question. The link to that is in the show notes. So, getting into the quick personal update, it has been almost a month since launching my debut fantasy novella, Fires of the Dead, and you can win a signed copy, signed by me. So, you can go to jedhearn.com/win to enter. Link to that is also in the show notes. It's only open for a few more days, so get onto that quick if you want your free signed copy of Fires of the Dead. And if you don't want to wait, of course, it's available in paperback, hardback, ebook, and audiobook right now. I have just discovered that you can get the audiobook, which I narrate, for free via your library. Just ask them how to do that or Google it. So far, I've seen about 12 people do that, which is really, I know it sounds small, but I'm really excited at the start of my author journey for that to be the number that's there, because that's really exciting for me. And it's really great because you can get the book for free, the audiobook for free, and I get about 60 cents with every borrow. So it's a win-win for both of us. So today's episode is about Words of Radiance. So this is the second book in Brandon Sanderson's Stormlight Archive series. It is a tome. That is one word for it. I think it is about 400,000 words, so it's massive. And there will be spoilers for this, of course. So if you don't want Words of Radiance spoiled for you, go ahead and read it and then come back when you've finished it in, I guess, a while, because it is a thick book. So basically, Words of Radiance continues where Way of Kings left off, which is the previous Stormlight Archive book. Our main characters are still at the edge of this really big war that's going on between two different races. There is magic involved. It's really hard to kind of summarize the second book in a series when the first book was the length of five individual novels, but I'm going to assume that you have a base level of familiarity with Words of Radiance, and it won't really matter for you to be super familiar with Words of Radiance for this episode anyway, because I'm going to be analyzing just a particular scene and I'll give you plenty of context with it. So, there's a key moment in Words of Radiance that gave me chills, like genuine chills, and just made me grin with the intensity of what I was reading and the emotional experience I was going through. It literally made the hair stand up on my arms, and it gave me this incredible emotional and physiological reaction. That's so rare. And it's even more precious. Like, I can only think of really a handful of movies, of books, of plays that have done this to me. And Words of Radiance maybe had even the biggest impact out of all of those. So here's that moment that gave me chills. It's at the end of chapter 56, which is titled White Spine Uncaged, and then it's kind of the whole of chapter 57, which is called To Kill the Wind. Great chapter title, I love it. And of course, it's not really at the end of chapter 56 and the whole of chapter 57, because this is a fight scene, and like any good fight scene, it's only good because of the 250,000 words that have come before it in this book alone, and then the whole book that's come before that. But anyway, I digress. So there's two key characters involved with this scene, Adeline and Kaladin. So Adeline is a light-eyed noble who is trying to help his honorable father gain political power by essentially engaging in duels with other people throughout the war camp, which they're all in, with the intention of trying to win stuff off those other people so that his family gets more powerful and gets more leverage. Kaladin is a dark-eyed soldier. So in the past, he once trusted a light-eyed noble in the Stormlight Archive world. The races are kind of split into light-eyed, who are sort of the noble upper class, and then the dark-eyed, who are sort of the subjugated lower class. So Kaladin in the past once trusted a light-eyed noble, and it led to him being branded as a slave and forced to serve in these horrific conditions as a bridgeman, who is someone who literally does what they say in the title, a person who carries an army's bridge along with the rest of their crew. So you can basically think about a bridgeman as like being a slave who rows a warship, except it's easier to get shot with arrows when you're carrying a bridge because you don't really have the ship to protect you. So in book one, Kaladin mastered his magical powers to kind of liberate the bridgeman, and now he works as a guard for some light-eyed nobles, specifically for Adeline's family. Kaladin and the other bridgemen work as guards for that particular family. But, of course, his past and his tragic backstory and relations with nobles means that he doesn't fully trust them. He thinks that Dalinar, who is Adeline's father and the head of this family, he thinks that he seems like an alright guy, but Kaladin is just very suspicious, and he is understandably scarred by his horrific experience as a slave and because of his betrayal by the Light Eyes. So in this scene, Adeline is tasked with fighting a rival noble in this duel, and whoever else the noble wants to bring to this fight, Adeline kind of just, you know, gung-ho says, oh, you know, I'll take you and whoever else you bring to this fight. It's basically his way of trying to incite the opponent into coming to the fight by promising him a really unfair advantage. So Adeline is light-eyed, and he has access to these weapons called Shardplate, which is this armor that's, you know, pretty much impenetrable, and Shard Blades, which are these swords that can cut through basically anything, except other Shard Blades. And when they cut through something, they sever the soul from it. So if a Shard Blade, you know, cuts through your spine, you're dead. If it just sort of nicks your hand, you're probably going to lose the whole arm. That's how powerful these things are. Wars are literally fought and won by Shard Plate and Shard Blades. Those are kind of the big kind of magical weapons in this world. So they're really powerful, and so he wants to duel other Shard Bearers with the aim of winning and claiming their stuff. And he's doing this to kind of advance his family's political power, because there's a lot of political power struggles going on in this scene, as with any good epic fantasy book. I mean, you know, love some of those political machinations. Now, of course, you've probably spotted the loophole in Adeline's challenge that he'll fight this rival noble and whoever else he wants to bring to the fight. Because instead of the opponent bringing two people, which would be an incredibly hard feat for Adeline to defeat both his opponent and an ally, his opponent comes with three other Shard Bearers. Whoops. So now he has to fight four people. And he thinks about, you know, backing out, but he is a man of honor, even though he knows his opponents will do their absolute best to, quote-unquote, accidentally maim or kill him. So he fights. For a time, he does well, but then he weakens, and it looks like he's going to be defeated. Or killed. Now, what happened next is the moment that gave me chills. and I don't expect to do it justice in this podcast form, because it will never compare to having read 650,000 words that built up to this scene. But I'll do my best. And if you've read Words of Radiance, hopefully you had the same kind of emotional experience in this scene, and you'll know what I'm talking about. And maybe that will let you relive that scene and hopefully get those chills. So we'll do our best. So Adolin, the light-eyed noble who Kaladin detested throughout the book for his casual racism towards the Dark Eyes, is struck down because he's outnumbered 4-1. Adolin's father, Dalinar, appeals to the crowd, pleading for someone to leap in to help his son because new people can join the duel at any time. So I'll read what happens next, and this excerpt comes from the end of chapter 56. Dalinar turned upon the stands full of spectating light eyes. "You can watch this?" he shouted at them. "My sons fight alone. There are shard bearers among you. Is there not one of you who will fight with them?" He scanned the crowd. The king was looking at his feet. "Amaran. What of Amaran?" Dalinar found him seated near the king. Dalinar met the man's eyes. Amaran looked away. "No." "What has happened to us?" Dalinar asked. "Where is our honor?" "Honor is dead," a voice whispered from beside him. Dalinar turned and looked at Captain Kaladin. He hadn't noticed the bridgeman walking down the steps behind him. Kaladin took a deep breath, then looked at Dalinar. "But I'll see what I can do. If this goes poorly, take care of my men." Spear in hand, he grabbed the edge of the wall and flung himself over, dropping to the sands of the arena floor below. And that was the moment that gave me chills. Just this badass scene of Kaladin leaping into the arena. I should have seen it coming. I didn't, and I was glad I didn't, because it was just this incredible, incredible experience of bravery, and it was just wonderful. Anyway, back to the episode. I was digressing in my love for that scene. And the reason why this scene is great is because it's not just an action scene. This is about a man who is enslaved by the Light Eyes, who was enslaved by the Light Eyes, rather, coming to a light-eyed man's defense. So imagine someone punches you in the face over and over again, and then they trip over. Are you going to help them up? That's basically what Kaladin's doing in this scene, except multiplied by 1,000. This is a scene about a man who's wearing nothing but his clothes, holding nothing but his spear, leaping into an arena to face 4 soldiers armed in impenetrable armor and holding swords that can cut through anything. This is about Kaladin overcoming his fear of revealing his magical powers, which up until this stage, he didn't want to demonstrate in front of other people because he was afraid they might see what he can do and, you know, take his powers away or try to kill him. It's about Kaladin overcoming his fear as well of trusting the Light Eyes. And last time he trusted a Light Eyed, it led to him becoming a slave. How can that not give you chills? It's just such a powerful scene. And I think one of the reasons why comes back to Donald Mass and his wonderful book, The Emotional Craft of Fiction. He describes in this book the importance of integrity. "We can, of course, feel strong emotions for anti-heroes," he says. "But there's something special and hooking and gripping and emotive about someone doing the right thing despite overwhelming pressure to look away, to be a bystander." And this moment when Kaladin leaps into the arena is a moment of transcendent goodness. It's a moment belonging to a hero. So the feelings I experienced in this scene and in the following fight, which is amazing in its own right, especially with how it ends with another big twist I didn't really see coming. The only way I have to describe it was kind of through this analogy, a few years ago, I was lucky enough to go to Rome and explore the Pantheon, which is this 2,000-year-old temple. And walking in there is incredible. It's this huge, cavernous, half-domed space. In the ceiling above, there is a hole, a single hole where light streams through. And I don't know if this was by design or not, but when I was there, the circle of light coming through the oculus, that's the hole in the ceiling, it lined up perfectly with the arch of the entrance doorway. And this feeling I had in the Pantheon, this feeling I had in this scene where Kaladin is leaping into the arena, I like to define it as an experience of the sublime. If you're wanting readers to have chills, what you're really doing is you're wanting them to be experiencing the sublime. So what is the sublime? As with any good bit of research, I started by Googling definitions. And the Cambridge English Dictionary defines the sublime as, quote, extremely good, beautiful, or enjoyable, end quote. Kind of a bit useless, don't you think? Because my intent is to understand how to create sublimeness in our own stories. So that doesn't really tell me a lot. It's not something I can work with. There is, however, a more useful definition of the sublime in The World as Will and Representation, which is a book written in the early 1800s by Arthur Schopenhauer. So for Schopenhauer, the feeling of the sublime is, quote, in seeing an object that invites the observer to transcend individuality and simply observe the idea underlying the object. End quote. I'll say that again. For Schopenhauer, he defines the sublime as in seeing an object that invites the observer to transcend individuality and simply observe the idea underlying the object. Now, I wouldn't necessarily agree with all the terms in that definition, but this isn't really a philosophy class. This is just me trying to find definitions that are useful at articulating kind of more vague emotional responses I had to a work of art. So to translate that definition, which we'll work with for now, into story terms, we might say the feeling of the sublime is created in experiencing a character performing an act that invites the reader to transcend their individuality and achieve emotional understanding of the thematic truths underlying the character. Now, I know that was a lot, so I'll say it again. The feeling of the sublime is created in experiencing a character performing an act that invites the reader to transcend their individuality and achieve emotional understanding of the thematic truths underlying the character. When I first conceived this episode that you're listening to right now, I thought about doing this as, you know, a kind of list. And you can easily imagine how this would go. If you want readers to feel chills, you've got to do the following things, which are all things Sanderson did with Kaladin in this scene. You know, number one, constantly repress the character through repeatedly blocking him or her from achieving their underlying need, thus preventing them from growing as a character. Then when you finally allow them to experience what they need, not necessarily what they want, it's like releasing a dam that's been holding water back for decades. And then number two could have been, have the character do a genuinely honorable or admirable action despite great opposition. And again, this is referring back to the emotional craft of fiction. Perhaps number three would be create massive stakes, both on a plot level and emotionally. And Sanderson does this well, of course, by spending prior chapters foreshadowing and building up the duel from multiple characters' point of views. This shows that it's a really big deal because it's going to affect a lot of people. And then number four, the kind of nebulously titled, be badass. Sanderson's zeroth law of magic states that the most important thing when considering magic, or really anything else in a story for that matter, is that it should be awesome. Awesomeness allows you to trump some other minor logical things at times, and I mean, it doesn't get more awesome, mythical, and more dramatic than Kaladin's exchange with Dalinar before dropping into the arena. You know, let me read that again. "What has happened to us?" Dalinar said. "Where is our honor?" "Honor is dead," a voice whispered from beside him. And then, of course, later, "But I'll see what I can do." That's just so wonderfully mythic and dramatic. And it's very cinematic as well, the way that Kaladin just sort of drops into the arena. You can easily imagine his cape sort of tattering, sort of flapping behind him in the breeze as he drops to the sand and lands in a crouch and then looks up directly at the camera and then he charges into battle. So I gave you this list because I think it's helpful, but, and here's the key point, but I don't want it to be the focus because my thinking and understanding really matured, I think, as I was preparing this episode. The thing is, creating a sublime story isn't about following a checklist. I think a checklist will help, you know, and this checklist that I've provided, I might even use it in future stories. But sublimeness is really numinous. It's really kind of vague and abstract and emotional. And having said that, while I don't think a checklist is the best way to achieve that, I do feel pretty confident in saying that it does ultimately come back down to that idea that we explored before. That idea that sublimeness is experiencing a character performing an act that invites the reader to transcend their individuality and achieve emotional understanding of the thematic truths underlying the character. Let's unpack that a little bit. So experiencing a character, that means empathy. That means dramatizing a struggle within or outside the character that readers in some way can relate to. Now, you've probably never gone through what Kaladin has. I really hope you haven't. But you've probably been shamed. You've probably been picked on. You've probably been bullied and lost your faith in other people at some stage in your life, even if it was just for a tiny moment. Kaladin's arc, then, is an extreme amplification of primal, archetypal human experiences. So in your stories, consider how you can make your character's struggles, no matter how great or small, an expression of a part of the human condition. And of course, you know, this idea of the human condition isn't singular, of course. But remember, this is about expressing something that feels true to you. To you. Not everyone might identify with it. But if you're true, and you express something that's true to you, it will find an audience because there are 7 billion humans walking around on this earth after all. So the next part of that definition of sublimeness in a story was performing an act. And this is pretty basic. For me, it's hard to kind of achieve sublimity in a character just thinking and not really doing. You know, you can look at things like The Great Gatsby, which did it successfully in book form, and some films do it really well too, but they of course have the benefit of music. Authors don't. So most of us mortals require some external action as a reflection of a character's internal struggle. And this is not a concrete rule, of course. You know, nothing I say is really a concrete rule. It's just guidelines. But it is something to consider. It is kind of easier to have these big moments of readers experiencing sublimeness in some sort of action. The next part of that definition was invites the reader to transcend their individuality. So transcend meaning sort of rise above or, you know, go to the next level. So returning to my first point, this is about identifying with the character. Sublimeness is about leaving your own ego and your own individuality and experiencing awe and appreciation in something bigger than yourself. It's a night of stargazing and being aware of the immensity of the cosmos. It's in falling in love. It's in experiencing a character overcome titanic struggles yet still remaining a person of integrity. Emotional understanding. Now, this is really the crux. It's all about emotions because in Words of Radiance, you know, we spend pages where Sanderson objectively walks us through Kaladin's plight, but until this moment in the arena, it doesn't quite hit home. Remember, people forget or are going to forget what you say, but they won't forget how you made them feel. And again, I would highly recommend the emotional craft of fiction for further pointers on this. And then the last point of that definition, thematic truths underlying the character. Of course, it all comes back to this great unifier, theme. So Robert McKee uses the term to describe theme as a story's emotional argument. John Truby defines theme as, quote, the writer's view of the proper way to act in the world, end quote. And another way Truby says to look at it, which I find useful, is as the story's moral argument. So a really quick example here. The theme in A Christmas Carol is that money can't buy happiness. And that theme gets explored from both sides of the argument, which is the difference between theme and preaching. Preaching is you just explore it from one side. So you might be asking, Jed, what's the theme of Word of Radiance? And this is a hard one, because the book is just really big. Like I said, 400,000 words. But I'll have a crack, and I'm very willing to hear your suggestions. You can email me at jed.hearn1@gmail.com and let me know what you think the theme is, and I might even respond to your comments in the question segment of the next episode. But the beauty of this is that every reader will probably take away a different theme, and that is totally okay. In fact, that's what makes theme so effective. So one clue as to the theme of Words of Radiance might be in this story that Caladan alludes to, which was told to him by Wit earlier in the book. So he tells the king, quote, "We all die in the end, so I guess what truly matters is just how well you've run," end quote. And in many ways, this scene where Caladan jumps into the arena to help Adolin to jump into the fight shows his progression towards embracing this thematic truth. It doesn't drive him all the way, of course. That honor lies with the breathtaking climax, which I should stress that I massively enjoyed and got more chills reading it, but I wanted this episode to focus on the duel, because it's difficult for a book's climax to give you chills. It's almost impossible for a book to give you chills at the 3/5 mark, which is where the duel falls and exactly what that scene does. Words of Radiance isn't a book. It's an experience. And an incredibly emotionally satisfying one, which is amazing considering that it is just the second book in what is expected to be a 10-book series. So it's no secret that I love Brandon Sanderson. But right now as I record this, I would comfortably say that Words of Radiance is easily my favorite Brandon Sanderson book. It doesn't just have this amazing world building, this cool magic, or really great characters. It has all that and something more. Something sublime. And that's our episode. Now, onto the first ever round of questions. I would love hearing your questions and comments on this episode, previous episodes, the writing craft, my own stories, or anything else that you think is relevant. And you can submit those questions by going to jedhearn.com/question. The link to that is in the show notes. Or you can email your questions to me, jed.hearn1@gmail.com. So today's question comes from an interview I did for Fires of the Dead, which is my debut fantasy novella, just came out about 3 weeks ago, and it was over on the Synopsis by Sarge book review blog. So Nikki asked on the blog, what was your inspiration for the book? Take a quick sip of water before I answer. So with some stories, I can't really recall where I got the initial idea. And I think part of that is because ideas are really cheap at the end of the day. I think of writing as 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration, and all of that. But with Fires of the Dead, I remember it perfectly. So I was in Japan with a friend, visiting another mutual friend who'd lived there for a couple of months, which is really great because we got free accommodation in his tiny Tokyo apartment. And one day we walked through a graveyard. Not a famous shrine or some big tourist attraction, but a small collection of markers and buildings opposite a school, and with, you know, a bunch of Tokyo's many vending machines out the front. There are a lot of vending machines in Japan. So coming from Australia, I found it really fascinating to learn about their belief system, because, you know, walking through a graveyard, it's just something that there is a lot of evidence about. How people respond to death really kind of tells us a lot about cultures, I think, and a lot about the human condition in general. So as I walked through this graveyard, I looked at the family shrines, and some were big, some were small, some were clean, some were decrepit. And I wondered, what if paying respect to your ancestors wasn't this kind of one-way action? What if they talked back? And by no means is this an original idea. You know, there are a lot of cultures that kind of have this idea, and there are a lot of books that explore it. And so after writing concepts in my notebook, it just sort of stewed in my head for a couple of months. Then I started thinking about magic. So as will be no surprise to you, having just heard me rave about how good Brandon Sanderson is, I love unique magic systems. And I was brainstorming some of my own. There was this one idea I created called pyromancy. Pyro meaning fire, mancy sort of meaning magic. Technically, mancy means divination, but it's often associated with magic, so that's close enough for me. And of course, the rule of cool, pyromancy, just sounded like something cool. So how this magic worked was really simple. People would bond themselves to a fire by dropping blood into the flames, and then they could draw energy from the flames to project their own fires. So simple rules, but as with many other great magic systems, it kind of has a lot of different applications. So I chatted with my friend over table tennis about this idea, and we spitballed, you know, a dozen or so permutations of the concept. And I went away with a better idea of how this thing worked, and, you know, I'm really grateful for that friend. I'll say your name. Thank you, Rain, for giving me ideas about how this thing would work. But there was this missing piece still. Who would maintain these great fires? Because a pyromancer could build a huge bonfire and get really powerful, but then they'd always have to take care of it, and that would be a pain. So then I remembered these shrines in Tokyo. And I started thinking, what if these shrines weren't just memorials, but were furnaces? What if each pyromancer family built this kind of communal fire, and then each dead ancestor lived in the flames? And now powerful families would have raging bonfires filled with hundreds of minds, and weak families might only have a furnace in the basement. So building your fire would increase your family's power. And like in any good fantasy world, people would only want more power. So mashing these ideas together resulted in fires of the dead. And there's a ton of other inspirations, of course, but wanting to explore pyromancy kindled my initial curiosity for the book. And interestingly enough, rewardingly enough, I feel like the story became way more character focused than I expected it to, which I think has definitely been to its benefit. And I think I often seem to do this because unique magic systems and cool world building really draws me in. But at the end of the day, it's the characters that make me stay, and hopefully they'll do the same for you. And once again, if you want to win a signed paperback copy of Fires of the Dead, just go to jedhearn.com/win, link in the show notes, or you can pick up a copy right now online, or order it in through your library, or order it in through your bookstore, or whatever is the best way for you. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you've enjoyed the new format. I would really love to, you know, hear some comments, thoughts from you on the new format. You know, do you think it's better? Are there any questions you want to ask me? Any comments on episodes? I'd love to hear it. And you can email those through to me, or you can tweet me. I'm at Jed Hearn on Twitter. Thank you so much for listening. Now go and write extraordinary stories. I'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.